So you're going to do that proof with Newton's method and do it right. Quadratic approximation part right. And walk out of here some time. We get done with the Newton's method stuff. I'll talk about defining the exponential function and how you prove that it is its own derivative. Well, another thing to note is I finally posted to Angel all those extra proofs from day 16 about derivative rules, like sum rule, product rule, inverse function rule, and that tricky sub sequence thing that I used when I was proving the chain rule. So if you want to see the proofs of those other differentiation rules, take a look at that. And I'd like to soon get some stuff related to day 17 up there as well. So, of course, I should note homeworks, 17 and 18 are due on day 20, which is Wednesday. Let's talk about Newton's method. So I want to get that quadratic approximation thing down first. So this will be the first thing we need. If F is differentiable at A, and I have another point B, and B is, I don't really care what happens to B except that F is defined to B, so B isn't going to do anything with that. Then I can find a parabola that does three things for me. The parabola is going to get the value, the height, correct at A. It's going to get the slope correct at A. And it's going to get the height correct at B. So I wrote G. What's G? Where G of X is just my parabola. The parabola will have there's really not much choice for the constant coefficient. The way I'm going to set it up, I want to do it in powers of x minus a. So that forces my hand for the first two coefficients. And the f of b is going to force my hand for the quadratic coefficient. However, I don't actually care too much what that quadratic coefficient is. I just need to know that there's some coefficient that makes it work. Okay. So if you draw a picture of this, something like this. So we have our graph, and who knows what it does, but
anyways, you have a point here, say, and the function, you assume the function is differentiable there, so there's a tangent line. Okay. Maybe this is A. Then you pick any other point, right, say B over here. It doesn't have to be the right of A, it could be to the left of A. And what this is saying is that I can find a parabola that goes through this point, has the correct tangent at that point, just like my original function, and goes through the graph over here at B. So G is some parabola. Does that. A parabola in a circle along with that. Yeah, I'm not going to do a proof by a picture because my pictures are very imperfect. I'm going to do an algebraic proof. Okay?
Maybe I should get some other colors, right? Easier to see which graph this one.
Today. Okay. G of A is just F of A plus F prime of A times A minus A, which is 0, plus C times A minus A squared. So that's another 0. So this is F of A. There's no problem there. And likewise, G prime of A, so this is just a parabola, and X, take its derivative. So we'll get f prime derivative of x minus a is 1 minus 0. Let's go ahead and let's take the derivative first, then we'll plug in a. I don't want to cause confusion here. Okay. 0 plus a constant f prime of a is 1 minus 0 plus a constant c times, hit it with the chain rule, so it's 2. Times x minus a times the derivative of x minus a, which is again the 1 minus 0. So at a, things are going to work out just fine. I mean, the first part of this is just really the tangent line formula. Right? So everything works fine. So 0. F prime of A times 1 plus C times 2 times A minus A times 1. This term is 1, as I was saying. This is A minus A, which is 0 when I plug in A. So it all works out. Okay. So it's clear, you know, what to do at first. Use the tangent line formula you learned in calculus. 1. So it's just a question, okay, well, what, we just need to get something that'll hit the other point correctly. Okay. There's nothing exciting happening there. It's just plain old high school algebra, maybe middle school algebra, once you've got the other stuff correct. Okay. We're just gonna write down a requirement, right? So we want... better marker. This is one of mine. Okay, so we need this board needs to be cleaned all over again. I should bring my cleaner.
Maybe it's the eraser. Anyways, okay. So we need, let's just plug it in here. We need f of b to equal g of b, which according to our formula would be this. I got that right. Okay. I can do that. Just solve for C. Okay? Subtract the f of a from both sides. Subtract this f prime of a times b minus a from both sides. Okay? And after you do the subtraction from both sides, divide both sides by b minus a squared. Okay, so what are we going to get? Do the subtraction, as I said. And then divide through by b minus a squared. And that works. I specified the b not equal to a, so I wouldn't get division by zero. If you had b equal to a, then this would all be kind of trivial, because if b was the same as a, and g of a equaled f of a, then g of b would also equal f of b. So this is only really an interesting statement when the b is different than a anyway. That's the end of the proof, so I'll put a little box. Traditional symbol for the proof is done. You can generalize this. If you have one derivative, you know, you can get your function to be approximated by a parabola that matches the function and its derivative at one point and matches the function at a second point. If I was twice differentiable, right, you could imagine doing something else, like. So, and in general, if you had an nth derivative, get a polynomial that matches all the derivatives up to that nth one at a. And then you could rig the highest order term of your polynomial to match the height of b. I may come back to the details on what exactly the coefficients are for that polynomial later. Either it'll happen today, or some of it'll happen as homework, or I'll get to it when I get to Taylor's theorem. Right? Because in Taylor's theorem, I need to be able to tell you what the coefficients 0 through n are here. If you look up Taylor's theorem in your calculus book or on the internet, you'll know what the coefficients should be in any case. Again, if you just take derivatives of both sides, you'll see that it's clear what it has to be after you plug in a. So
So we'll come back to that. But let me use this now for what's called the second degree extended Rawls theorem. So we talked about Rawls theorem before, which said that. Let's recall the original. If you have f continuous on a closed interval, so maybe not differentiable on the endpoints, but at least continuous on the endpoints, and f prime exists everywhere in the middle. It might exist on the endpoints too. That would be great, but we don't need it. So let's see. And say the function is zero at the start and at the end, right? And this is like the special case of the mean value theorem we proved first before. Our proof reduced the mean value theorem to a special case. And we used the extreme value theorem to prove this. And the pictures are very natural, right? You have a function, it starts at zero, it ends at zero, so whatever it does, there's going to be some horizontal tangents, right? There could be many. So there's many possible values for C here. I don't want to necessarily make the derivatives at the start and end be even exist, right? So potentially, you know, it's very steep there. Alright, there's lots of potential places. In this example, there's three places where the derivative is zero. And with my nice little function that starts at n zero. There could be many, but there's at least one. So you have to, if unless you're just totally flat, in which case you have a horizontal tangent everywhere, then you either go up and then come back down somewhere, or you go down and then you come back up. Maybe both. In any case, at the turning point, it's a horizontal tangent. And you can, of course, make that a formal proof you did that. So what's the second degree one? I drew a picture of it last time in the middle of my botched proof. It basically says that if you add an additional condition here, so now if f prime not only exists, but is continuous on the closed interval. So I'm going to include the endpoints now. So it needs to have derivatives on the endpoint, and the derivative function needs to be continuous. And I want f prime itself to be differentiable. So that means there's second derivatives. Maybe not at the endpoints, but they better be everywhere in the interior. And now, my additional condition here is that now not only does it start and end at zero, but it starts with a horizontal tangent. Okay, so the picture would look like this. Here I'll draw something that, unlike this picture, I'll have it start with a horizontal tangent. And it does something interesting, and then whatever it does, it starts and ends at zero. So my claim now is that there's an inflection point in the middle. It's going to switch between concave up and concave down somewhere. Right? In this picture, see, right here is concave down, here it's concave up. The inflection point is about there. Right? So that's a potential solution here. Let's see, where's the inflection point?
about here, right? So that could be another value or an inflection point. And where's my inflection point here? Something like that, right? There, again, I drew a picture where there's like three solutions. Maybe a fourth one over here if you think that it switches to concave up before it gets to B there. Just like my parabolic approximation theorem over there, this can generalize to higher degrees. So that, like, if you had the first 10 derivatives and the function value all zero at A, and the function value was zero at B, then you could find an intermediate point where the 11th derivative was zero. Stuff like that. Okay? But for what I'm going to do with Newton's method, I only need to go up to the second degree form. Talk about the general form later in the context of Taylor's theorem. First, we just use the regular Rawls theorem, okay? Picture of this. Here's starting at a horizontal tangent, say, right, and starting and ending at zero. Right? Just hitting it with the regular old Rawls theorem says, okay, look at one of those places where it turns around. Right? Got a horizontal tangent. And now what we have are two horizontal tangents, right? One at A and one at D. So this is what happens when you graph F. Think about graphing F prime now. Okay, F prime is zero here, and in this particular example, it goes positive, then it goes negative, right?
And the inflection point is where it's the steepest in this case, right? It gets really steep, gets as steep as it can be about there, then it gets less steep, right? So the graph went look something like this. And then it's getting, you know, pretty negative. This is what the graph looks like. So this is your graph of f prime, okay? Now, I assumed, right, f prime was continuous on the closed interval and differentiable on the interior, right? The fact that f prime is even exists at all on the closed interval implies it's continuous on the closed interval. And of course, exists on the open interval. So it was legitimate to apply Rawls' theorem to f, because if f is differentiable on the whole interval, it's continuous on the whole interval and differentiable on the interior. But I need a little bit more to use Rawls' theorem again, right? Let's see, I need that Rawls. Now I need that the derivative is in turn differentiable, and that the derivative is continuous. That's exactly what I need to use Rawls' theorem again. So now I'm looking at f prime, and I know that, okay, here it's zero again, there's a turning point. So the derivative of f prime, which is the second derivative of f, to graph it right, I'm not sure I graphed it quite right. Your inflection point should be corresponds to turning. So that's all there is to it. If you just assume you can differentiate your function enough times and still have it be continuous, then you can just keep using Rawls' theorem again and again and again, assuming that you can still find places where your derivative is zero at two places. You can then find something where a higher derivative is zero in between. So if A had, you know, all seven of its derivatives equal to zero, I mean, if F had all seven of its derivatives equal to zero at A, and its value at A is zero, then I could use Rawls' theorem, you know, eight times and find some point to the right of A where the eighth derivative is zero. Now what I do is I put together the second degree extended Rawls' theorem and my quadratic approximation claim, right, approximating the function by a parabola in that nice way, to get the second degree Taylor's theorem, or at least one version of it. Yeah, left out some words. We'll talk about the general form. I'm hinting at how to generalize all these things already, though. Okay. So I'm just going to assume the same hypotheses that I need to use that extended Rawls theorem. If, again, if my first derivative exists and makes a continuous function, you consider it on the closed interval A to B, and the second derivative exists everywhere strictly in between A and B. And so f is differentiable on the interior. So it's got second derivative everywhere in between. Then there exists some number in between. Use a different letter this time, let's call it Z. Some number in between A and B such that, what? such that f of b equals f of a plus f prime of a times b minus a. So this is just the tangent line approximation of f. And then the second degree Taylor's theorem tells me that I can put the leftover part in a special form. So if I have a function and I use the tangent line approximation for it at A to estimate the value of the function at another point B, this says that the error in that approximation is some, can be expressed in this kind of quadratic term. Okay. Now this is good, okay, because if b minus a is small, if b is close to a, then b, then the square of b minus a is really small. Like the square of 1 over 100 is 1 over 10,000. The square of 1 over a million is 1 over a trillion, right? So this is good, right? If you can get b close to a, then this error here can be really small. Unless, of course, your second derivative is really big at this z. But if you could show that between a and b, the second derivative doesn't get very big, then by making b minus a small, and hence b minus a squared really small, you can make the error term small. And so let's do it from here. So let g of x be the quadratic approximation term. Approximation, you automatically, I mean the constant linear terms automatically get the function value and the derivative right at A, and then just choose this C like we did before. So where C is as before, such that we get the function value correct at B. Talked about before of that quadratic approximation, the g of a equals f of a, and the g prime of a equals the f prime. So you get this approximation, and you want to hit it. You want to hit it with extended Rolle's theorem, but we need some zeros. So what do we do? Take the difference. F minus g will be 0 at a and at b. The derivative will be also be 0, right? Because f and g have matching derivatives at a. So the derivative is 0 at a, the value is 0 at a, and the value is 0 at b. Is all this stuff still valid? Well, yes, because because all we're doing is subtracting a polynomial from f. Okay, so it's continuous on the closed interval and differentiable on the open interval, because
I assumed F was nice in that way. Continuous on the closed interval, differentiable in the open interval. And because G is very nice, right? G prime, in fact, G double prime, in fact, exists everywhere. So there's no problem. G changing F by subtracting G is not going to screw up the derivatives or their continuity, right? G prime, what's G prime? Take even G double prime. Take the derivative of this, it goes to zero. Take the derivative of this once, it becomes one. Take the derivative of it again, it's zero. Take the derivative of this, you get 2c times x minus a. Take the derivative again, you just get 2c. So g prime is differentiable everywhere, so it's continuous everywhere. So f minus g, you do that, f prime minus g prime, i.e. h prime, will be continuous and differentiable everywhere f is. Extended Rolle's theorem. This is the second degree form that we're using. We can find that point C, that inflection point, for H now. H double prime. Okay. So 0 equals F double prime of C minus G double prime of C, because H is just F minus G. So what? So, no way, I should use C, right? I should use Z, right? That's what I picked. I didn't want to use C because I was using a capital C already. This little point Z is what I'm getting now. Okay, so F double prime at this inflection point Z is the same as G double prime Z, but G double prime is this 2C everywhere. Alright. So we're almost done. One last thing, we need f of b to somehow equal this. Well, the key is we have f of b equaling this parabola g of b. And the only thing we didn't understand about the g was this coefficient c. Right? We had some complicated formula for it earlier. But all we really care about is that there is a coefficient that works. And now, with the extended Rolle's theorem, we can get that coefficient to be 1/2 of the derivative of f, the second derivative of f, so from somewhere in the middle. So f of b equals g of b, like how we chose g, and g of b in turn equals, I'll just plug in b, okay, f of a plus f prime of a, times b minus a. Plugging into my formula for g, plus the c, which I now have understanding of in terms of a second derivative of f. 2c is f double prime at z, so divide by 2 to get c. And then there's an x minus a squared, right? This is the parabolic term, or quadratic term. And so I'm plugging in b, so I get exactly what I want. Okay.
questions or comments about that?
It's a good thing I gave an extra day to this, because I really need some more time to explain it properly. Still haven't gotten to Newton's method part, right? Okay. In this setup here, I had A less than B, but if you swap things around, there's no problem. Okay. So you can have a second degree Taylor's theorem where you make the approximation from the right instead of from the left. Take the mirror image, basically. Everything works. So it's not important whether A is to the left of B or B is to the left of A. You can totally swap everything around. It works just the same. So here I use the tangent line at B, at the right end point of the interval, to estimate the value at the left end point, and then there's an error term that I can understand in terms of the second derivative from somewhere in the middle. So it's like over here, I'm just going to draw a picture, we've got the function has got it does something like this. Okay. And this was our tangent line. This is what you call the error or the remainder term, right? Right there. That's that gap. And you can take the mirror image of that picture and do the algebra, and it's all going to be the same the other way. This time I took the tangent of B, and you get some error term, right? Or remainder term, depending on what you want to call it. And you've got a Z somewhere in the middle that if you understand the second derivative, you can understand how big the error term might be in terms of a quadratic multiple of the width of your interval here. And trivially, if A equals B, right, then this is all, very silly, right? So I mean, if there was no real interval, if there was no non-trivial interval, and we just had one point A, right? Then if you plug in all the formulas, either one, left or right approximation here. You can get something. I mean, here it doesn't even really matter what you put, right? All the terms except that term die, right? If you try and do a quadratic, in this trivial sense. So if you put all that together, like the approximation from the left with a tangent line, approximation from the right with a tangent line, and then kind of the trivial case where you already have the function at the point of interest, you get a general result, right? I is an interval. F is continuous on I, and F is differentiable, i.e. F prime, F double prime, the second derivative exists on the interior of I, so we exclude endpoints if there are any. And then you have any two points, P and Q in I, not saying whether P and Q are equal or not equal, not saying whether P is less than Q or Q is less than P, if they're different, just any two points. Then, just taking the, this base case here, we did this, and then we said, okay, if we take the mirror image, get the same kind of formula. It's also the trivial case for the same. You can summarize it all in one case as just saying, you make a tangent line approximation at P, say, and then F of Q has to equal F of P plus F prime of P times Q minus P. That's just the usual tangent line formula you learned in Calculus 1. And then some error term that is quadratic in Q minus P with a coefficient there. For some z between P and Q. Right? So that's kind of the general way of combining all three cases, including the trivial case, into just one general statement. And that's what we'll do for Newton's method. All of them. So let me walk through Newton's method argument. Now I want to try and make things concrete here. So I'm going to pick a particular function, and I'll show you how you could prove that Newton's method works from some starting points, and how we could actually find a starting point at which we could prove Newton's method would work. We have a two-stage game. Basically, we'll use the bisection method, which is reliable, to get us close enough that we can use Newton's method. Okay? And be sure that it's going to work. Let me just make sure my pictures aren't blurry here for reference. That's good. Okay.
just going to do simple here. F of x is x cubed minus x minus 1.
Now, to start, let me just make some educated guesses here. It's negative if you plug in 1. It's positive if you plug in 2. So there's a root between 1 and 2, right? I mean, this is fine. Not only is this continuous, it's all its derivatives exist everywhere, right? You don't have to worry about, well, is it are the derivatives continuous, or can you differentiate enough times to use the Taylor's theorem stuff? It's all good. It's just a polynomial. You can differentiate as many times as you want, wherever you want. Okay. So, I mean, it's certainly continuous between 1 and 2, so you can use the intermediate value theorem. Because it's negative 1 here, and then later it's gone up to 5 somehow. I'm not making any claims about whether it's concave up or concave down. You can look into that. I think, well, okay, looking at it, yeah, it's going to be concave up, but anyways. We'll get to that. There's a root in there somewhere. Bisection method to get as close to C as we want. Okay. It's not clear how close we need to get before we can switch over to the much faster Newton's method and be, you know, 100% confident that it won't lead us astray. So we use the bisection method to get close enough, and we'll compute how close we need to get. Okay, how do we even know we're close to C, right? We don't even know what C is. There's a way, right, to prove that we're close enough, because we already know, we know C, you know, is somewhere in here, right? So, like, at the midpoint, 1.5, wherever C is, it's less than 0.5 away from 1.5 in either direction. Okay, so this is not hopeless. Did the bisection method more, and then used a midpoint from some little subinterval we had, and we could get even closer to C. Find x1 close enough to C, and that's our starting point. And then here's Newton's method. So we need to make sure that this never, ever steers us wrong. we want to
so it'll work and we can prove it. So in particular, I'll prove that, you know, we're never going to get a division by zero once I find this close enough starting point, and that the limit in the limit, I really will converge to the root. So the whole sequence will be well defined. I'll never divide by zero. And this limit will be this mysterious number C. Okay. So, to use the Taylor theorem, degree 2, write out f of c in terms of a tangent line from some xn, assuming we haven't had a blow up yet. And so we'll kind of work backwards. We'll see how things work without knowing that we're close enough, and then we'll see how close we need to be. Okay. Let's see if we get the formula. So it's f of x. Yeah. Okay. Here's the Taylor approximation using a tangent line at xm. So somewhere between c and xn there'll be this thing. Okay, so now think about plugging, we want to basically plug in this formula into here. So I'm going to solve this for f of xn, okay? Zero is the value of f of c, right? C is that root that we know exists by the IBT, but we're not sure where. Okay? So zero is equal to all this, so solve it for f of x. I'll just swap, trying to make it too weird. Okay, so just subtract these things from both sides of the equation. Cancel it out here, bring their opposites over here. This is zero. When we do the division, take this term divided by the f prime of xn. It doesn't cancel here, though. Okay. Wait, okay. Sorry, there's a minus there, so it's...
So these become pluses, sorry, see?
So I have these minuses, and plug them into here, there's another minus, so they're pluses.
I was worried, I was like, wait a minute, things are supposed to cancel. Right? See, the xn's cancel. Subtract c, and it doesn't matter which way you write this thing, but... Okay, so this is the key formula. I'm going to rewrite that one like this. Okay. And it doesn't matter which, if I flip these, you know, when I square it, it doesn't matter. Okay. So the magnitude of the difference of our next guess to the true root is then equal to the magnitude of f double prime at some intermediate value, divided by twice the magnitude of f prime at our previous guess, times the magnitude of the distance of our previous guess to the true root, times the magnitude of our previous guess to the true root again. Is to have this always less than some number r, or at least no bigger than r, where r less than 1 is a constant, then every time this thing will be getting r smaller, and so it'll converge. And of course, once this is small, we're going to be squaring it, right, in here. So it's not only going to converge, but it's going to converge really fast. Okay. Well, we better never divide by zero, right? And we better never have a big second derivative. That would cause us problems. So let's get some estimates. And let's get some estimates on those things. Well, I'm going to go ahead and compute those. So what do we got? F prime of x, it's just a cubic polynomial. 3x squared minus 1. F double prime of x, 6x. Okay, we can estimate those. I already have got myself down to an interval 1, 2. So I could figure out, how bad things could get, in my interval 1, 2, right? But there's a little wrinkle here. How do I know that even if I start with a guess like 1.5 in 1, 2, that I'll never leave? How do I know that the Newton's method, even though I start in this interval, it won't throw me into somewhere else, like outside of 1, 2. Okay. So the way I know is that if I can get this thing here always, smaller than 1, right, then I'm always getting closer to C. So the sequence of distances to C is a decreasing sequence because it will always be getting smaller, but it will always be getting smaller by this factor of at least of r. It may be getting smaller faster. This is just some kind of estimate that I'll get. Okay. So what I want is an interval centered at C, okay? Even though I don't know where C is, okay, so I'll have to approximate it by an interval I do know about, okay? So here's what I need. I need an interval A to B and a, say, delta positive such that somehow I know that the interval of center C and radius delta is contained in there, even though I don't quite know where C is yet. Okay. So I may not know, you know, where C is, but I can cover it by some interval I do know about. And then I need to make sure that this thing doesn't get too small, because then that would make this fraction big. So I need A greater than 0, such that on my interval that I somehow find that the derivative is always A far away from 0. So just for any input, right? Because who knows where Newton's method is going to take me. But at least on this interval, I'm not going to get anywhere close to dividing by 0. Right? At least no closer than this number A. Okay? And then I also don't want the second derivative to be too big. So also on my interval of control, of some capital B, where I have an upper bound on the size of the second derivative. And I need all of this. So I want to start sufficiently close to C, right? Okay. So I need x1 to be in that starting interval. Okay. And then I want this to be at most some constant r that's less than 1. So the r will be made up of my a in the denominator, that b in the numerator, and then also a 2, and then an upper bound on the xn minus c, which would be my delta. Okay. So I know that if I have all that, then I'll know that I'll never leave this interval. I can include the endpoints. It's really not a big deal. So what do I need? I need b over 2a times delta less than 1. Okay. So how are we going to get, you know, like the delta, say? Well, once we get our x1, we're just going to, you know, say, you know what? We really have little clue about where C is, so, you know, we're going to define, I guess I'm using I here, so I'll continue in the first person singular. So I'll define just delta to be x1 minus C. Right? So, okay. Kind of like the worst case scenario, so to speak. Right? And then how about covering, right? And so if I do this, then I want to make sure I cover this. So what am I going to do? Then let A just be C minus 2 delta and B equal, not C, I don't know what C is, right? X1 minus 2 delta. And B is going to be X1 plus 2 delta, okay? So I have my x1 that I'm going to find using the bisection method, and then I can go out delta in both ways, okay? And somewhere in there is, you know, C, or maybe it's on the left, I don't know. Maybe it's all, right? Well, actually, I guess the way I define delta, it's going to be on the endpoint, right? But I don't really know what delta is. Wait a minute. No, I had to. I'm sorry, I can't quite just magically take a difference with something I don't know about yet. So I'll get delta from I'll get delta and x1 from bisection. Okay. Okay, so C is going to be, delta will maybe be an overestimate, but C is somewhere in there. And then the point is, even if C is all the way over here, if I go delta further, right, that B will still be big enough. The x1 plus 2 delta will still be far enough to the right to cover a potential C plus delta all the way out there. And then likewise, going delta further this way, right, the A will be far enough to cover even a potential C minus delta from if the C was way over there. Without more bisection, right, than I've done, I haven't done any real bisection yet. What do I have now? I just have that, what I wrote over here, right, that I could use 1.5 for the x1, and then the delta could be the 0.5, okay? So what about the A and the B? So underestimates here. Okay. So that would lead to. Okay. So A. Let's think about this. Okay. So I want to avoid zero. So as long as I keep the x at least, past root, or the root of 1/3, I'm fine, okay? And then at the left endpoint, okay, so this would be that. This will be at most 6b lowercase if zero is at least x is at least b. Okay. Now, from my method here, right, I would have A equals 1.5 minus 2 times the delta, so. And the B would be 1.5 plus 2 times the delta. Okay. So if you did B over 2A times delta in this one, sorry, I'm almost done. I'll email the homework like I've done last week, so if that's what you're wondering about. Okay. 6 times 3. Let's see if this one works. Well, 6 times 2.5. I'm pretty sure this is not going to work, by the way. Right? We're going to need to do some bisection to actually get in there. And then here you would have already you're getting into trouble, right? Because that's not true. Okay. So this is not good enough, all right? So what you need to do is get some more bisection in there,
Looks like I have to let you go. I will finish it up, but you don't have to stay. I'll
take a few more minutes and I'll put it on the chalkboard.
But I know you may need to go, and that's fine. But yeah, all you need to do is just bisect a few more times, get that delta smaller. Okay? And then we'll be able to prove Newton's method works. So I won't be offended if you leave. And I'll email the homework.
It might work if we start at 1.5, but we haven't proved that.
So we could try this, okay? So try the midpoint of that, 1.25, and then delta equal 0.25, right? And because I know that'll get me close enough, right? That's a delta where x1 will be close enough. And then I have to run my numbers here. So let's see, the little a and the little b. So a, okay, subtract off two deltas. Let's see if that works. So the first concern is, are we even bigger than root 3? There's a sign switch between this one and 1.5. So I'll try the midpoint of that, which is 1, 1, 2, wait, no.
1.375. Halfway between 1.25 and 1.5. Bisecting. And now the delta is 0.15. Minus 0.25. No worries now, that's definitely greater than 1 over root 3. It's 1.90 repeated forever. Okay, so that's too big, right? We need it smaller than one. Okay, so still not yet. Okay, so I am going to need to go to this next level here. Three times 1.125 squared minus 2.79875. Maybe I'll just write it down here. Times a delta of 0.125 divided by 2, and then divided by 2.79687. And you get 0.2178, whatever. It's less than 1. It works. Okay. So,
if I start at 1.375 and use Newton's method, it will converge to the true root and very, very fast, provably. Okay? So that the second degree Taylor theorem is enough information to tell us why it works so well, provided you start close enough.